have a visa, you couldn't do humanitarian aid or just things that were like, how do you say, free. So we really did have to come up with a business there, and the business we came up with was a coffee shop and an English school. And so I just want to start us off on that note to say thank you to this church. I'm going to give Dale some coffee from one of our coffee shops. Actually, this was from the one we just opened in Turkey. Actually, it's been open a year now. I was just there last week. It's called Story Coffee. Please don't email that around or put that on the internet. But the great thing about it is it gives our workers, we usually don't even use the word missionary because it's a really high security word, but our workers there, gives them visas and platforms to minister in the country. And so Dale and Bonnie, we'd like to give you some coffee, and maybe you can share it on St. Patrick's Day. We've had to be pretty creative through the years in these countries, to remain there, to remain somewhat safe, and to be effective, to be really risky and bold. So I'd like to tell you about one girl in particular, and I think we have a slide of her. In the early days, I was teaching at the Agricultural University. I was teaching English, and we would gather students after class. We rented out the Lenin's Museum, and we'd say, if you want to practice more English, you can come there, and we'll have a very informal time. And this day, the guy, his name is Mahat, and he's a student in the ministry, but the gal in the middle, as you can tell, she looks a little older than like an 18, 19-year-old. And I saw her, there's about 100 students in this room, and I saw her from across the room. She looked real different. She had this real bright lipstick, and I thought, I wonder who this person is. So I go walking up to her, and I'm like, hi, my name's Dina, and she grabs my face and just like kisses me straight on the lips. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, wow. And they do kiss each other, but this was straight dead on. And I thought, this gal's really excited to meet me. And truly, she followed me, and we're walking down the street, and I'm going home, and it's almost like she wanted to go with me in my home. And if they're with you, you pretty much have to invite them in your home. And so she had pretty good English, and she was about probably around 28, 29 at the time. And I said, well, her name is Jildiz, and that means star in Kyrgyz. I said, well, would you like to come in and eat with my husband and I? So she did. And we're sitting there, and Dan's more of an introvert, so fewer words. And he was a little tired of listening to me and Jildiz chatter. And as the dinner finished, he took the plates and went into the kitchen. And she looks at me, and she says, what is the matter? Nothing's the matter. She says, is Dan mad? No, Dan's not mad. She says, but he is in kitchen. I said, yeah. And then she hears the clanking of dishes, and she says, he's doing dishes. I said, yeah. She goes, you are princess. she didn't really know, like, the democratic society I came from. But anyway, that was our intro. Jildiz really wanted to be around me because a lot of people want to leave the country, and really the avenue to leave the country is to know English and to possibly work with an international company. But little did I know, her backstory was so thick. About 2 weeks later, we had talked a lot at the dinner table, but I usually don't just lay down the whole gospel right there because you're really building trust with people and you need to kind of know them and build somewhat of a relationship. We talked about a lot of things. We did talk about faith. I brought up Jesus and my faith, which is very normal to do because in the Muslim culture, they believe spiritual beings are floating around and everywhere, and there's good and there's evil. But she came back after a couple weeks, and she says, I have to talk to you. And I said, great. And she says, I told my whole village, they can't say a V, I told my whole village about you, about love, true love. I said, really? Well, what did you say? I told them everything we talked about at your house. And I thought, wow, I must have given a pretty good, explanation. I didn't know I was that effective. But anyway, and I said, really, tell me, like, what did you say? So she went back to this village and told all these very fundamental Muslim, they're covered and everything, but she's coming from the capital. And she says, I told them about Dan doing dishes. Yeah, so much for my greatness. But anyway, that kind of the little thing like that launched us into really a great relationship. And Julius and I spent a lot of time together. And when finally I was getting to know more about her story, it really was a struggle for me to accept even like how God works, to be honest. So how did she end up in Bishkek? That's the capital of Kyrgyzstan. She's from a village, and she was, they have this tradition in Kyrgyzstan where they call it wife stealing, and they take a girl, and then it's kind of like they take them to their house, and then they have them behind a curtain, and the whole family looks at her, and then if it's approved, they keep her for the night, and they tell the family of the woman, we want to marry her, and really, they do need to just stay with this man, whether they know them or not. And usually families know each other in the village, so sometimes it's not as extreme. But she was taken by a family when she was about 17. And the daughter-in-law of the youngest son moves into the home of the parents, and she'll stay there forever. So that's like their social security. The youngest son will take care of the parents. They never leave. And so really her duty was, she already knew her future. It was to be there and to what they call doing tea. They serve tea throughout the day and very much serve everybody in the whole household. So Gildas was in this family, but she did not get pregnant for a year. And that is very, concerning for the family, because having children needs to happen within the first year. And then another year goes by and another year. And so the talk became, we might need to find another wife because Jaleese can't produce children. But one day the family went to a wedding and she stayed home and to clean up, and she doesn't go to all the activities. So she's at home, and the father-in-law, an older man, stayed home as well. And during that time, you know, he says, you are my property, so you need to do whatever I tell you to do. And she kind of fought it for a while, but he took advantage of her and pretty much raped her that day. And she became pregnant shortly after. And it's like hush hush in the family, but everybody pretty much knows what's going on. And she goes into a birthing house. It's like our hospitals, but different. They actually have bars on the windows, and all the women, like 10 women in a room on cots, and then you have to go take them food and pass it through the window. I'm not sure why they do it that way, but she had the baby, and they brought the baby girl to her, and she saw her, and then they take her away, and then they're supposed to keep bringing the child back. But as the day goes on, she says, where's the baby? And they said, don't worry, you know, we'll bring her later. The next day comes. Where's the baby? Don't worry, we'll bring her later. And the third day, she's getting out of the hospital. And in the meantime, her husband had come to see the baby and took the baby and threw the baby in the dumpster behind the hospital. And the nurse said to her, because it's definitely a male-dominated society, your baby died. And so she left with nothing. The family told her, this is the sacrifice that needs to be made for your sin. And that night, she fled the home and found herself on her journey. It's like a 7-hour car ride. I don't know the details of that one, but she got to the capital city. But in the capital city, how does she make her way? Because her own family will not take her back, because that would shame her family. The whole thing is this vicious cycle of shame. So she finds herself kind of in the international circle of men, not a great situation, but that's kind of how she finds her way to survive. And then she finds herself in a situation trying to learn English on her own to get out of the country. And here I am. I show up from Central Coast into this crazy world of Gildas, and I meet her at the Lenin's Museum because she's trying to learn English. What a strange, like, crossing of lives. Like, my life could not be any more different than hers. And I really got upset about it. Like, how is it that I was born where I was born? Why do you let so much happen to her? And yet I will say that she, when she put her trust in Jesus, it was like the depth of grace and forgiveness and new hope that she understood is probably unlike anything I could even fathom. And she put her trust in the Lord. She actually lived with us for some time because there was no place for her to live. And she was the instigator of so much of our ministry, actually, after that. She's bringing home people every day, you know, a pregnant girl or whatever. And it was like, okay, we've kind of got a youth hostel going here. But she understood brokenness. And, you know, I was looking at the quilt you have up here of the lighthouse. And I think, you know, everybody has a backstory. There's like this tapestry of events that are going on that bring us to our own story. And I thought, if you take one piece out of that quilt and you just look at that one square, you have no idea what grander picture there is. And we are, our lives are a bunch of pieces, brokenness, crud, happiness, all kinds of stuff, blessings and curses, so to speak. And yet when you put it all together, we are a masterpiece. It says in Ephesians 2:10, you are God's masterpiece, you're his workmanship. And we don't understand the little pieces, but when he puts it together, it's for his glory and his greater purpose for us. So thanks for having us, and Dan's going to take it from here.
So I started to see a little bit of this idea that God's got a bigger story for us as I was reading through the Gospel of John. Or as Jesus was walking along, he saw a man who had been blind from birth. Rabbi, his disciples asked him, why was this man born blind? Was it because of his own sins or his parents' sins? It was not because of his sins or his parents' sins, Jesus answered. This happened so the power of God could be seen in him. And as I read that, kind of this prickly cold wave of fear came over me. And let me explain why. So about 20 years ago, I was in a church and I heard somebody talk about the Westminster Catechism. And I don't know if anybody in here is Presbyterian, but 400 years ago, if you wanted to be part of the Presbyterian Church, you actually had to pass a test for church membership. And that test had 107 questions on it. And so people would study for years to be able to pass this test to become part of the Presbyterian Church. And the first question on that test was, what is the chief end of man? In other words, what's our purpose for being here on earth? And if you're a good Presbyterian, you would know that the answer is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And so about 20 years ago, I heard that and I thought, that kind of makes sense. I like that. I'm all about enjoying God forever. And so I want to enjoy God now. I want to enjoy God for all eternity. And this kind of shaped the way I did ministry. And so when I'd approach non-believers, I'm like, it's all about enjoying God now and forever. And what a great package. Well, it turns out that the first part of that phrase is true also. That the purpose we're here on earth is to glorify God. And this verse indicates that God is willing to let somebody walk around for 20 years or more in blindness in order for him to be glorified. God was more than willing to let this guy live his whole life in blindness so that he could bring him to the moment where he could be, where God could be glorified in his life. Not only that, if we read through the rest of John chapter 9, we find this guy was begging when Jesus found him. So God let this guy go through his entire life of poverty and financial hardship so that he might be glorified in his life. Everybody in the town ridiculed this guy. So God was willing to let this man experience public shame so that he could be glorified at this moment in his life. So I didn't really like that part of the Gospel of John, so I kept moving along. So I thought if I just keep reading, maybe it'll go away. And then I came to John chapter 11, where it says that Lazarus, who is one of Jesus' best friends, was sick. So although Jesus loved Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days. And if you know the rest of the story, Lazarus ends up dying. And then Jesus brings him back to life from the dead, and Jesus is glorified, and God's glorified. And so I thought, not only is Jesus willing to let people walk around in blindness so that God could be glorified in their life, he's willing to let his friends die so that he could be glorified in their life. So I didn't like that either, and I kept reading. And I came to John chapter 12. And here Jesus is speaking, and he says, now my soul is deeply troubled. Should I pray, Father, save me from this hour? But this is the very reason I came. Father, bring glory to your name. Turns out Jesus is willing to let himself die that God would be glorified. So, being glorified is God's prime purpose for your life. That God would be glorified in your life and in my life. When we lived in Kyrgyzstan, we moved over to this Muslim shamanistic place we'd never been to before, and we thought, oh, we have the task of telling college students about Jesus. And we realized we don't know anything, and we don't know who these college students are and what they think already, and so maybe it would be good to do a little survey with them. So we started doing a survey with college students, and we did a survey with about 100 college students in Kyrgyzstan before we ever launched any ministry stuff. And one of the questions we asked them is, what is your goal in life? And when I went around to students, I went to the first student and I said, what's your goal in life? And the guy says, to become a person. I thought, it's kind of an underachiever. You know, you're kind of there already. You don't really have to do anything to do it. It doesn't seem like much of a goal. So I went to the next guy and I said, what's your goal in life? And this guy says, to become a person. And after about 90 students saying to become a person was their goal in life, I realized maybe I don't really know what they're talking about. And so I went to one of the Kyrgyz guys that I knew that had recently become a believer, and I said, okay, when people are saying, I want to become a person, what do they mean? Because it seems, you know, not that exciting of a goal in life. And he said, oh, that's easy. Here's what it means. So you're up in the village, 1,000 other people with you. Everybody's a sheep herder and whatnot. And then you move to the city. And when you're a kid in the village, nobody respects you, and you're just kind of low man on the totem pole or whatever. And then you move to the city, and you get a college education, and then you move back to the village, and now you've got a little bit of status because you've got an education. And then you get married, and then you really get some status. And then you start having kids, and before you know it, you're walking down the street, and everybody says, oh, that's Vaishbhai K. Everybody knows who that is. So now you're a person. So the goal in life is to become a person. And I thought, you know, we use different words, but we kind of want the same thing. We say, I want to be somebody. I want to be somebody. I want to move to New York City and make $1 million. I want to be somebody. I want to be the business owner here in Cayucas, or I want to be the mayor of the city, or whatever it is, because I want to be somebody. I want people to look at me and respect me and feel like I've accomplished something important in life. Well, let me just tell you, for the Kyrgyz and for us as Americans, being somebody is not God's goal for your life. He has something much, much bigger than you just becoming a person or being somebody or accomplishing all your dreams. His goal for your life is to glorify him. And if your life is all about your life, when you get to the end of your life, all you'll have to show for your life is yourself. But if you live for the glory of God, you'll get to the end of your life and have a much bigger picture to show for your life. One of my favorite spiritual books is called The Knowledge of the Holy by A.W. Tozier, and if you haven't read it yet, it's still out there, probably on Amazon or whatever, even though A.W. Tozier died in the 60s. And he is by far my favorite spiritual author. And in this book, Knowledge of the Holy, A.W. Tozier basically walks through the attributes of God. And it turns out God is wise. Who knew? So here's what A.W. Tozier says about God being wise and wisdom. Wisdom is the ability to devise perfect ends and to achieve those ends by the most perfect means. All God's acts are done in perfect wisdom, Not only could his acts not be better done, a better way to do them could not even be imagined. An infinitely wise God must work in a manner not to be improved upon by finite creatures. So, if God's doing some stuff in your life right now that you're not excited about, it's only because you don't see the big picture yet. Because you're still looking at the one square in the quilt, and he's looking at the full picture down the road. I think our next slide here. I thought maybe when I first saw this, I thought it was a Photoshop deal or whatever, but turns out it's a real thing. So there was another author that I've been reading lately, and he is a South African shepherd that became a pastor and decided to write a book about Psalm 23, which says, "The Lord is my shepherd," from the perspective of a shepherd. And so here's what Philip Keller says about this picture. A heavy, fat, or long-fleeced sheep will lie down comfortably in some little hollow or depression in the ground. It may roll on its side slightly to stretch out or relax. Suddenly, the center of gravity of the body shifts so that it turns on its back far enough and the feet can no longer touch the ground. It may feel a sense of panic and start to paw frantically at the air. This only makes things worse. It rolls over even further, and now it's impossible to regain its feet. As it lies there struggling, gases build up in its stomach. As they expand, they cut off circulation to the extremities of the body, especially the legs. If the weather is very hot, a sheep like this can die in a few hours. And I thought about Philip Keller talks about when he would see, when he was a shepherd and he'd see buzzards circling in the sky, he knew that this had happened to one of his sheep. And so he would rush out there and he would immediately flip the sheep back over and start massaging the legs and then kind of move it on down the path. I thought, isn't this a great picture of our lives? We're seeking a little comfortable spot to lay down and stretch out and relax, not knowing that it will ultimately cost us our life. Unless Jesus comes along, does something difficult in our life, flips us back over, massages all the things in our life that we thought were so comfortable, and keeps us moving in the right direction. Because God's purpose for us is to glorify Himself, not to make us the most comfortable, not to solve every problem that we have, not to give us a hassle-free existence. His purpose for you is that you would glorify Him and enjoy Him forever. As Dina mentioned, after we lived in Kyrgyzstan for 10 years, we moved to a country right above Iran called Azerbaijan. And it was also a Muslim country. And within the first few... So after we left Kyrgyzstan, we had the choice to go to serve the Lord in Italy or in Azerbaijan. And some temporary insanity came over us, and we chose to go to Azerbaijan for some reason. And about 2 months in, we decided maybe we should change our mind and go back to Italy. So Azerbaijan is this windy desert peninsula. We get water for 2 hours every other day. And so everybody fills up this giant metal tank full of water on their house so that it's gravity fed into your house. Well, it turns out in the winter that metal tank freezes. And so we moved to Azerbaijan in January, and for the next 4 weeks we didn't have any water. And so we, you know, were out with the other Azeris with blow torches trying to melt our frozen block of ice on top of our house, and then when that didn't work, we would gather snow from outside and we would melt it and we'd use it to wash the dishes, and then with that same water we'd wash the floors, and then with that same water we would flush the toilets. And Italy looked pretty good. And about that time, we thought, okay, we can endure this for maybe 6 months, 9 months, and then let's just get out of here. And the Lord led me to Jeremiah 29, where the people of Israel had been taken out of Jerusalem and taken into captivity in Babylon. And they thought they were going to be there just for a couple days because the Lord was on their side and they were going to get out of there. And God steps in. He says, hey, you're going to be here for a while. So build houses, plant gardens, marry off your kids, because I'm going to have you here for a little bit. And I read that, and I, again, flipped to a different chapter because I didn't want to hear that. And so we decided to build a house. And in Azerbaijan, if you buy a piece of land, it has to be in the name of a local person. And then once you build the house, you can change all the documents to get the house and the land into your own name. And so we sunk our entire life savings into building a house in somebody else's name. And for about 3 years, we paid about $30,000 worth of service fees to get signatures on documents to show that this thing was really ours. And every time we'd pay the last $2,000, they'd say, oh, you just need one more signature after this, you know, and then we'll give you the final document. Well, that went on for 3 years and $30,000. And so in the middle of this, I'm a little bit stressed out. And the guy whose name our land was in a shady business deal, and the government had threatened to seize all his property, which was our property. And so I was stressed out and, you know, complaining. Yeah, I probably rarely, but, you know, turns out we lived right next door. We had bought this piece of land together with a Presbyterian minister who probably knew all the answers to the Westminster Catechism. And he comes to me, and I'm complaining to him, and he says, don't do or say anything now that you'll regret when the Lord comes through. Don't do or say anything now that you'll regret when the Lord comes through, because he will come through. So if God in his wisdom is messing with your life right now, don't do or say anything now that you'll regret when the Lord comes through. One final story before we wrap up. So part of the best part about living overseas and working in missions is that you get to work with some of the best people in the world. And one of those people we used to work with, much smarter than I am, and he decided he was going to come back to the States and start a film festival, of all things. And so we were out there reaching Muslims together. He goes, I'm leaving. I'm going to go start a film festival in Seattle. I'm like, you're crazy. So he starts this film festival on redemption, short films on redemption. And this thing becomes huge, and he has people submitting hundreds of 5 to 15 minute films on redemption. And then he sends those films back to the mission field so that we can use them for evangelism and discipleship. I thought, this guy is smarter than I am. So he sends us this film, and in this film, there's a woman driving in this kind of older car, and she's driving through the middle of the forest, and it's pitch black, and her car dies. And, you know, they got scary music in the background. And so you're kind of already scared before anything ever happens. And so she's looking out the windows, and she's a little scared. She locks her door. She cracks the window a little bit, and she tries to get some sleep so she can figure out what she's going to do in the morning. Well, all of a sudden, she hears this noise, and she kind of sits up. She's looking around. She doesn't see anything, and then she looks in the rearview mirror, and there's this homeless-looking guy right behind her car with this hood on. You can't really even see his face, and so she ducks back down and tries to make sure he doesn't see her, and then she's, you know, not knowing what to do, so she's kind of curled up on the front seat like that, Then all of a sudden, this guy comes and he starts banging on her window, boom, 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 boom. And then he starts saying, it's like he's either deaf or a mute or something like that. So he starts kind of saying unintelligible words like, so of course she thinks he's there to attack her. So she starts freaking out, go away, go away. And so he sticks his fingers through the window and she rolls up the window on his fingers and then he goes like that, and then he's yelling at her, and then he starts walking away, and she doesn't see him for a while, and so she tries to go back to sleep, and then all of a sudden he's banging on her hood, and she's freaking out, and she's screaming, go away, go away, and he comes back to her window, and she's screaming, and she sees him walk away from the car, and she kind of lets this sigh of relief, and then she sees him pick up this big boulder. And he comes back to her window and he smashes her window with this boulder. And of course, she's on the other side of the car screaming her head off. And he reaches in and he grabs her by the feet and he starts dragging her out of the car. And she knows she's in trouble. And then they show her a great camera angle with her hands on the steering wheel. And as he's pulling her off, her fingers just slowly going like this and getting yanked out of the car. And as soon as she gets yanked out of the car, a train comes and hits the car and takes it about 500 yards down the track. You know, God may be knocking on your window through circumstances in life, and you could open the window and talk to him and find out what he wants, or you can fight him on it and ignore him and push him away, and he's still going to drag you out of that car and he's still going to save your life, but it's not going to be nearly as pleasant. God has created us to glorify himself and enjoy him forever. So whatever God's doing in your life right now, it's toward that purpose. So don't do or say anything now that you'll regret when the Lord makes the picture clear. And let's just enjoy him and embrace the Lord and embrace whatever he's doing in our life and ask him to be glorified in us. Thank you.